Hello and happy Friday. Thanks for tuning in to the Bulwark Podcast. It's August 2nd, 2019, and I'm joined in studio with David Priest, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare and a frequent podcast guest. He is the author of How to Get Rid of a President and the Presidential Book of Secrets. David, thanks for coming.
Hi, Jim. Glad to be here again.
So a couple days ago, we had two debates on CNN. As I joked earlier this week, I think the executive producer was Quentin Tarantino. There was a ton
I saw no blood. I thought there would be blood at a few points.
It was like a Tipper Gore video game. But a lot of violence, no blood.
I didn't see the severed limbs that you expect in a Tarantino film, right? Or at least an ear flying somewhere. We got none of that. We got the fireworks associated with it, but not the actual gore. And yes, that's a reference to earlier Democratic debates.
So your takeaway, and I don't know how much, I only watched, I guess, 80% of both. I thought I was tuning into the end of the first one, and it just went on for another 2 hours. But your takeaways is big winners and losers.
Well, it's hard to say because I focus so much on national security issues, and national security issues were, they weren't completely absent, but they were not prominent in the debates. So I found my attention going in and out, not fully focusing on who was getting in the best line about Medicare for all as opposed to the worst line on that. It sure looked in the first night that Pete Buttigieg again looked on substance like he was head and shoulders above almost anyone else, that he's thought through these issues. He knows what he wants to say. He knows how he wants to say it to communicate his message. Whether that's resonating with all Democrat Party voters, I don't know. I'd like to think so, because that's at least the kind of presentation to Americans that I prefer more than populist screaming, promising everything to everyone in almost a rant. So I like the style, but I don't know whether Democratic voters really want that. Polling suggests that he's, you know, in the bottom of the top tier. But he sure seemed to look good.
I think he's already qualified for the debate in September that
right.
they're having.
And then in the second debate, I was more distracted by some of the people than I was attracted to some of the people. Cory Booker did better than I think he had before, and that definitely came through. Honestly, I think Delaney represented himself fairly well. But I'm not sure that anyone really stood out that much. And that's the problem with these early debates is...
You shaved head guys. You all stick together.
We have to. We get so much ribbing.
It's
so,
a caucus.
You know, it seems to me that in these early debates, you have a strategy, unless you're one of the top four or five candidates, which is you really have to make a name for yourself and not in a Marianne Williamson kind of way. You need to show that you are clearly better on X, Y, and Z than these front runners, not to mention the other also rans. And I'm not sure that happened for any of them. Sure, some people got some punches in. Sure, Tulsi Gabbard went after Kamala Harris a little bit. But it wasn't the kind of thing that's going to get her from 0.5% or 1% to 10 or 15 or 20%. And that's what you need at this point, because otherwise you're going to be Eric Swalwell and you're going to have to drop out early.
The night of the second debate, I had a horrible flashback to the very first debate the Republicans had in Cleveland that I went to. It just, you know, it wasn't at a theater. It was in Clevelanders, we call it Gund Arena or Quicken Loans Arena or Fieldhouse or whatever you want to call it. But I remember that and just seeing that big stage, the audience and the people doing the warm-ups from the party. I just remember Reince Priebus was out there and I'm like, oh no, you guys are going to make this mistake. But in all of the post-interviews, the thing that struck me was Kamala Harris, for example, had a really good counter against Gabbard's attack and started going after her Syria connections and legitimizing and whitewashing perhaps Bashar al-Assad's massacre of his own citizens. And you saw this, you know, Bernie too, and people in these post-debate question and answer things. You think, why didn't we talk about this during the debate? And I suspect it's probably because like it's so staged and they have these lines that their consultants and their campaign advisors have said, this tested really well and you just need to use this line. But they were more freewheeling, and the post-debate Q&A things were better than the actual debate.
Truly. And part of it is a strategy, which is does Kamala Harris, who I should have mentioned, I think also did well. I think she did not hurt herself in any way and may have helped herself in some ways. But in the debate itself, when at least in theory more people are watching, does it help you to punch down? Does it help you to try to take out Tulsi by talking about Syria, which I'm guessing fewer voters in the Democratic Party care about than are already polling for her. I just don't see that as being a good use of your very limited time in this debate to attack someone who is unlikely to make a difference in the polling anyway.
It was the same thing when Elizabeth Warren, just John Delaney living rent-free in her head, and she just kept punching down, and he clearly got under her skin.
That's why I don't put her in the category of people who did exceptionally well, because she should have stayed on message. She has a message.
Don't elevate the nobodies. I might like John Delaney because, you know, I think Michael Graham said this earlier in the week on the podcast. He's the Democratic presidential candidate Republicans love the most. I might like him, but don't elevate him, because that only benefits him. It does not benefit you.
It's poor political strategy. But I've got to say, the format itself sucks. You've got 10 people on a stage per night, and yes, they did go on for a long time. But even then, only the top couple of candidates on the stage each night got more than, what, 7 or 8 minutes of talking time? And a lot of that was not well used. It's just not structured for a long, thoughtful one. I was harking back someone on Twitter, and I apologize, I don't remember whom, but someone on Twitter pointed out how one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates went, which was something like an hour presentation followed by an hour and a half rebuttal followed by a half hour rebuttal. Wow. That's substance. That's why we still go back to those debates and look at them and look at the evidence, the logic, the rhetoric used, instead of these 15, 20-second sound bites that are the best thing we're getting out of this debate format.
Yeah, and when Delaney came on our podcast, he said, the thing I love about podcasts is I could just talk about healthcare for 40 minutes. And he goes, and you can't even, if you don't know anything about healthcare, you can't understand healthcare, the economy, the market, the role of the government, the role of the federal government, states, regulations, all that. Like you can get a decent 52,000 foot view picture in a podcast over 40 minutes about one topic. But when you're focusing on these 15, 20 second sound bites, you know, it does not lend itself to constructive debate. And I don't like the call and response thing where if someone gets referenced, they get to, you know, he attacked me, you know, I get my time, because then you can game theory that into maximizing your time.
Sure. And they're competing values here, Jim. You've got the value, and I understand why they do that. It's fairness. It's the idea of if someone is attacked or even merely mentioned now, that they get the right to respond instead of just being shunted off to the side. I get that. But that competes against the value of responsibility. And is it really a responsible management of a debate to have that many people on stage, all of whom get to respond, to the point that you end up having some questions where it's just a show of hands on stage? That's ridiculous. That's the kind of reality show presidential contest that got us into this mess in the first place.
Yes, the show of hands was also a flashback that I did not like.
We can do better.
They should learn how to subtweet. So let's get to your most recent article for Lawfare that came out earlier this week. The potential trouble with nominating a DNI, or Director of National Intelligence, from Trump's central casting. And this comes at a time where when people are concerned about who are the adults in the room, who is handling things, either, you know, as a White House chief of staff, as someone who runs CIA or DOD or state, all of these people who we consider to be the adults have left, and one by one have slowly been replaced more or less by less competent people. I don't think there's really an example of someone who was initially part of the Trump cabinet from day one who was replaced by someone more competent.
Yeah, and the only example that comes to mind there, and this is a possibility, I'd have to think through it more, is at the State Department, because Rex Tillerson came in with no diplomatic experience and actually didn't seem to run the State Department well. That is, there was a lot of disgruntlement, not about policy, but about what he was doing organizationally within the department.
Right.
Mike Pompeo at least had done some work on foreign policy and national security, and of course had been at CIA for a while.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a step up, but you're still not talking about a Henry Kissinger here.
Right. He got his training wheels on the job in the Trump administration. But I think the interesting part, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't the story you wrote here come from a tweet thread that you initially had about the experience of, because the DNI, for listeners, and I'll let you kind of go and explain what this job is. It is not a position that has existed for, you know, the history of our republic.
No,
it's a relatively new
quite
position.
The opposite. Yeah, this has been around about 14 years, which is it's just a small amount compared to, of course, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General. But in fact, that's a long period of time when you look at it, because it's across three different presidencies.
Right.
Bush,
dates back
Obama,
to 9/11.
Dates back to the reforms after 9/11. So I believe the first DNI came into office in 2005. So we're going a little over 14 years. It has been institutionalized. There are still voices saying, do we really need the office of the Director of National Intelligence? Do they add value, or are they just another layer of bureaucracy? But fact is, the DNI has consolidated its position in terms of budgeting, in terms of overseeing the intelligence community. So it is a position that's there, and it is important. I'll separate out intelligence positions from some of those other ones you mentioned, like Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. Yes, they're all national security positions, and you want good people in all of them, and you want people who care about the objective truth and are trying to decide policy based on reality, not based on fantasy. That's all true. But there's a special role for intelligence. The intelligence community is the one part of the U.S. government, even above law enforcement in many ways, whose sole job is to tell truth to power. The idea is to tell the president and other leading policymakers what they need to hear about what's going on in the world, not what they want to hear. Every president and other senior officials, but every president has trouble with this. If you have a policy and you've put your heart and soul into it, maybe your reelection is hinged on it, and you have intelligence officers coming in and saying, hey, Mr. President, this thing isn't going well. You know, Iraq is a disaster, or Vietnam is a disaster. Not in terms of pronouncing judgment, but in terms of just describing what's happening on the ground overseas. You're a president, you get that, you don't like that message. It doesn't work well. But you've got to hear that message, because that's the only way you turn it around. That's the only way that a George W. Bush decides, based on the intelligence, we need to change policy and we're going to do the surge in Iraq instead of going what we've been doing. So that is the core role of intelligence. And when you have a director of national intelligence who has experience in the military and intelligence world, they know that. They know what their position is and what their role is. The concern with Representative John Ratcliffe is he does not have that background. His resume pales in comparison to any of the men who have held this job previously. In fact, his only direct exposure to intelligence appears to have been since he was put on the Intelligence Committee in the House, which was just over 6 months ago. Compare that to some of the men who preceded him, who had 30, 40 years of experience working with intelligence.
So over the course of the history of the DNI, Ratcliffe could have potentially, if he gets confirmed, and we can talk about whether or not he gets confirmed in a little bit, he went from being a mayor of a small town in Texas to going to being a U.S. attorney for, I think, a year, and then, was a Hill staffer, right?
Yeah, I don't know his full resume, but the things that he put out there on his own statements as kind of justifying his national security law enforcement credentials were serving as an interim U.S. attorney between two Senate-confirmed ones for around a year, the mayor of a town in Texas, some work in the Justice Department overseeing an office that dealt with some of these issues. There's some reporting out now in the last few days that some of his claims in his bio are exaggerated, sure, saying something like, prosecuted all these cases and
never,
took down all these aliens.
Never expect that in the Trump years.
I know. Who in this day and age fudges a resume? I mean, fact checkers get this. Now, it's interesting that in his...
And he's young, too. I mean, I take your point about...
I want to say young 50s. That's my guess.
Right.
I have to look that
up. But he's considerably younger than any of his potential counterparts. And I get your point. I agree with it, that especially in a very specialized field like intelligence, wisdom comes through age. It's not to say that young people don't have a role in the IC, but when you're getting put in charge of things, that experience, which he has very little of, matters. But another point you raised was, given his resume, and we can talk about maybe some of the comparable people at different positions as you do in the article about CIA and other positions, is that he has almost no experience managing large organizations. How big is the DNI in terms of its office? I mean, obviously it oversees, how many people, like 14 agencies or something?
The office of the Director of National Intelligence itself isn't that large, because the job is to coordinate, to manage. But there are people that are managed in some way or another by the DNI. But the issue is that they are supposed to coordinate the entire intelligence community, which is massive, tens of billions of dollars in the publicly declared budget for intelligence. That's a whole lot of people. That's a whole lot of effort that you are managing. And if you have managed a small town, or if you have been the manager of a personal congressional office of perhaps a few dozen people, that does not compare to managing the numbers that are involved there. Now, there is not a perfect correlation between management experience and success as a leader in the intelligence community. But we've got more than two dozen examples of leaders in the intelligence community we can look at, and you get a pretty strong sense that people who come into the office with extensive experience in intelligence, military, or other affairs, people who have experience managing large organizations, they do tend to do better, and more importantly, the ones who don't tend to do worse. You mentioned examples. I'll just throw one out there. Somebody who was at the time director of Central Intelligence, which was one of the hats that the CIA director wore managing the community, which the DNI does now, was a young, brash, doctrinaire leader, Jim Schlesinger. And he came into office for Richard Nixon, determined to rock the boat. Similar to some of the things we're hearing about Trump's goals in nominating Ratcliffe, which is to rein in the intelligence community, to stop them from running amok. Well, that was what Schlesinger was doing in the early 1970s. He came in, he was young, he was ambitious, he was smart, but he had very limited experience. He'd been deputy director of the Bureau of the Budget. I think he had run the Atomic Energy Commission for a small period of time. Both of those much smaller than the entire intelligence community. But he took an approach to his leadership role at the CIA that was akin to this drain the swamp idea. He threatened to dismantle the entire intelligence directorate that analyzes foreign intelligence for our leaders. He wanted to tell senior staff, and actually he did at times, barking at them, saying, remember who you work for. Sure sounds like politicization. Well, guess what? He was gone within months. He left the agency, considered to be one of the worst directors, and moved on to other positions. That's not exactly a parallel for what Representative Ratcliffe has, but there are some similarities that point to the fact that he would have a real uphill climb to be successful in the role.
Assuming, and we'll talk about the potential confirmation, because this is a Senate-confirmed position, here after a word from our sponsor, 8sleep. Today's podcast is brought to you by 8sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. When you look at today's world tech leaders and high-growing startup CEOs, I bet you wonder how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do. The answer will surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While Americans are not getting the same sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. Are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night long. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology, because that's annoying. If you want to sleep better, you can enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts, guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. You can try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, 8sleep will refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. And that's only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. They've already sold out of their first two batches, so they are going fast. And for a limited time, our bulwark.com listeners can get $150 off their purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHT sleep.com/bulwark. And we're back with David Preece, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare, talking about his article, The Potential Trouble with Nominating a DNI from Trump's Central Casting. We're talking about Congressman Ratcliffe and his lack of experience, both in the intelligence community and in government and managing large organizations. And we've seen some cold water from the Senate, and this would go through Senator Burr's committee.
That's right, the Intelligence Committee, I believe, would be doing the confirmation hearings on this, and then, of course, the full vote. This is what I've seen so far, and I'll be interested to see what we see and don't see in the coming days. I've seen Democrats almost universally saying, wait, what?
What the hell?
Saying,
Schumer, seriously? Of course. I mean, yeah. Schumer always gets hyped up about everything, but right. I think he's got a point here.
Well, they point to the fact that the justification for nominating Ratcliffe appears to simply have been Ratcliffe's full-throated defense of the president in public hearings and his attacks on the people the president doesn't like in those same hearings, rather than his actual resume. Now, that's not unique to this director of national intelligence position. Trump has done similar things in the past. But for a position like this, where in fact, which is the focal point for all U.S. intelligence going to the president, the DNI personally oversees the president's daily brief, the top secret document that goes to the president every morning containing the best secrets.
And as listeners know, that was in part one of the jobs that you did.
Yeah, I had to deliver the PDB back to a very different man named Bob Mueller back in the day, as well as other leading policymakers in that era. But that's where it all comes together. There's a lot of intelligence that goes to many other officials, but for the president, the best stuff goes in that book, and it is the starting point for a briefing that even Trump still takes several days a week, where intelligence officials come in and brief him.
When he takes it, you'd be really good at doing an audiobook form of it. He's more of a visual audio guy instead of paper thing. Do you think they could do a PDB audiobook?
I'm sure they do a version of it in terms of talking him through it, right?
Yes, the live in-person reading.
Right. And I guarantee you, because the whole history of this, which we won't get into again here, but the whole history of this is the intelligence community adapting to each president. And if President Trump said or indicated that he'd actually like to listen to an audible version of the PDB every morning, they would do that. They would record it and they would make it happen.
Or go on Fox and Friends.
Or they could just deliver it there. I have a feeling the content would be slightly different.
Not to joke about a serious topic, because this is what the politicization. I always screw this word up. I'm going to edit this out. The politicization of intelligence. Right. That is the fundamental. It's not just that we haven't had inexperienced people who've had intelligence jobs in the past. History is any guide. History is made every day. But having someone in there whose sole qualification seems to be presidential ardent defender, and the tenuous relationship with our allies and our adversaries, and how Trump has just kind of turned all of this stuff on its head. Having someone whose sole qualification seems to be sycophant, not like Dan Coats, who was a seasoned senator, House member, and ambassador, and did many other things, and maybe not the most qualified DNI compared to his predecessors, but certainly very qualified, especially by comparison.
But even compared to Dan Coats, Ratcliffe looks different, and there's no indication that there was a serious vetting process or rational calculation in the nomination of him by tweet. It appeared to have just been Trump liked him on TV and decided to put the name forward. So you asked, what does that mean for confirmation? Well, yes, we've heard Chuck Schumer say the obvious, which is that Ratcliffe is a partisan player and that this job requires some kind of intelligence expertise, but instead we're getting this. But you've even had some people who are not political making that point. But to me, more telling is what the Republicans are saying. Part of the process of vetting, part of the reason you do that, of course, is to expose things like errors on resumes. Part of it is also to quietly go to people who will be confirming the nominee to say, hey, what do you think of this guy? But it sure looks like they were surprised. The comments coming out, the most common comment I saw coming out of people who were asked about John Ratcliffe after the nomination by tweet was, who? And that was the Republicans. Now, that tells you something. It tells you the vetting wasn't done. But it also tells you that he was not seen as somebody who would be a likely nominee for this. Does that mean he can't get confirmed? Not by itself. But it does put up obstacles because he's going to have to introduce himself to the people who will be confirming him, as opposed to being someone that they already had in mind as a possibility for this job. That's a big hurdle in a confirmation process. It requires a different skill set to convince people that you are even minimally qualified for the job than it does to convince people that you have the qualifications, but you're the right person for the job. Unfortunately, he is in that former category right now. I would even go so far as to say that the very tepid response from Republicans and the harsh response from Democrats suggests that this may be one of those Trump, quote, nominations that doesn't get formally put forward as a nomination. I think there's a very good chance that he actually does not nominate him and instead goes with in acting for a long period of time, as he did at defense. Technically, the law says he can't do that. The principal deputy director of national intelligence, by law, is the acting DNI when there is not a DNI. But I would not put it past Trump to name an acting DNI anyway and dare someone to sue him over violating the law on that.
Yeah, because who would have standing, I guess?
Now, that would be hard. I'll defer to lawyers on that. But where we used to think that something that was in the law is where the Office of Legal Counsel,
it's like the
advising
the
president, tells them, yeah, don't do this. Now it's, yeah, if we do it, who's going to stop us?
Right.
It's a very dangerous thing.
And it is concerning. And if he does get nominated, I'm getting some shades of Rex Tillerson here. Because you remember when Tillerson was confirmed, and think back to those confirmation hearings so many years ago. It seems like a decade ago, but it was only, what, 2 years ago, right? That was a huge thing. What qualifies you to do this? I mean, clearly Rex Tillerson was an accomplished guy, but it just seemed like such an odd choice. And I remember those hearings and just the grilling. And Republicans even were skeptical of Tillerson,
they
too.
They were. And one thing that helped with Republicans, I have been told, is when...
Oil
money? Well, I haven't heard that. But I've been told that when Bob Gates and Condoleezza Rice both personally vouched for Tillerson to members of Congress and said, he's the real deal. He can do this job. Trust us. That mattered to some members who were on the fence. I do not see someone like, and they have to answer for that, obviously, based on what happened. But I do not see the equivalent of Bob Gates, Condoleezza Rice, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Jim Baker, the people who were the A-team of Republican foreign policy and national security over the last several decades.
That weren't never Trumpers.
I'm not seeing any of them step forward and say, absolutely, I will vouch for this man. Will that make a difference for everybody? Absolutely not. But for people who are on that fence saying, is this one we can hold our tongue and go along with? They may have done that with Tillerson because they had people they respected like Gates and Rice coming forward and saying, he'll be okay. If nobody is coming forward saying he'll be okay, that helps explain the radio silence from most Republicans on this and the comments from the others who have spoken out saying nice things about Dan Coats, but actually not saying anything about his potential replacement.
Yeah, so I think the smart money is that Congressman Ratcliffe's political consultant should definitely continue to file as if he's going to run for re-election, because there's, you know, a pretty
always good to have options, Jim.
Yes, always good to have those, and pretty significant chance he ends up like Stephen Moore or one of these other sort of, oh, no, we have the utmost confidence. You know, he's going to be on the board of the Fed. Totally going to happen. Let's go to a future here where he is confirmed, because law, nothing matters. No one of any substance or background will vouch for him. But Mitch McConnell will, we're going to have to confirm him and just, you know, get everyone in line. And he squeaks through with maybe a dissenting vote or two, but it's a total party line vote. He's the DNI. What are some of the ways that someone who is, and I don't know this man and I don't know his soul, but from all of what I do know, he is a partisan who is not an IC professional. Will Hurd could be a much better DNI, for example, just based on his straight qualifications.
And I would say would get, if not universal, near universal Democratic support for a nomination, which would be unheard of for almost any position in this administration. But I think in that case...
And he'd remove a critic. I mean, geez, I should be an advisor to the president. But... you put in some kind of partisan sycophant, and that's just how I personally view this guy. You make him DNI. What are some of the worst ways politics can really wreck the intelligence community? And if that's the concern, because Trump from day one not even before he was elected, has gone after the intelligence community. What are some, we don't have to come up with horrible scenarios.
No, there are multiple directions. But... Yeah, there are multiple directions this could go. Let me talk about two that would be among the most likely directions. One is actually a relatively positive scenario, which is that John Ratcliffe gets the job and decides that his role will be the interface with President Trump. So he attends, as apparently Dan Coats has been, he attends the irregular in-person briefings for Donald Trump. Maybe attends other meetings, perhaps more often than Dan Coats did, but basically says to the intelligence community, you know what? I'm going to interface with the president.
Make me a vessel.
Yeah, maybe he likes the FaceTime with the president.
I speak Trump.
And you know what? Maybe he does what Mike Pompeo did. Mike Pompeo came in at CIA, as you recall, and some people thought he was a bit too partisan. He had certainly been on the leading edge at the Benghazi hearings of really attacking Hillary Clinton, which was a good job qualification for a Trump nomination. And Mike Pompeo came in and started doing things like calling WikiLeaks a hostile intelligence organization and started being behind the assessments of Russian election interference. He was actually putting forward those objective assessments, not politicizing the intelligence on those issues, at least, and perhaps on all issues. So in a sense, the bureaucracy, the leaders in intelligence, the apolitical public servants who work in this business said, here is our job. We're going to keep doing it. Are you going to represent us doing that? And it appears Pompeo did. It is possible, and I think it is one of the more likely scenarios, that John Ratcliffe would do the same, that his eyes would be opened, that he would see, once he's open to all these things, more than he has been in the last 6.5 months on the job on the Intel Committee.
Maybe the oh shit factor.
Yeah, that he would see, you know what, this is damn impressive work you all are doing, and it's damn important we get it to the president and other leading officials. I will represent you, but I want my job to be with the president, because that's, maybe it's ego gratification, maybe it's setting himself up for another job. But if he does that, and if the intelligence community goes on to serve all other, what we used to call customers, cabinet secretaries, assistant secretaries, desk officers, military commanders, diplomats, everyone, that could just go on 99% the same way it has. And the only concern would be, would he be politicizing information he's giving to the president or not? So that's one way this could go. There's another way this could go that's also one of the more likely directions. And that is an attempt to actually rein in, using the quote that the president did, the intelligence community, actually change the way they do their job. And the main concern there is active politicization. The DNI saying, yes, all of you non-political career intelligence officers who have served presidents of both parties by presenting your information regardless of their political views, I get that you think that's your job, but I'm your boss and your job has changed. Your job is now to tell me what I want to hear. You're going to make the best case possible that, let's say, Russia is a land with, you know, unicorns dancing through meadows and rivers of chocolate and rainbows of Skittles, and it's a wonderful place, and that's what you're going to put in your intelligence report for the president.
That's just the Chernobyl exclusions.
We could have unicorns there. Have we examined that?
I think the
that would be a genetic
the Instagram change. Influencers, you know, that we're going to find out, because they're all flocking to Chernobyl,
yeah.
Which was a great show. I don't know if you watched it.
I have not, but I've heard. So it's on my very long list of things to do in my spare time that I don't have. But we could see that scenario. We could see a scenario where the DNI actively tries to politicize the product, perhaps even blatantly so. What would happen?
Or whitewash an atrocity.
Perhaps. And in any sense, get in the way of a normally functioning intelligence policy relationship. Now, what happens there? You've got other agencies. You've got the CIA. We've seen no sign that Gina Haspel would go along with that. That puts her in a position of having to go along in some way, having to try to navigate that and correct the message behind his back, or resign in protest. And that would be true of the other intelligence agencies as well. So you could actually have an effect of purging the intelligence community, which we have never had to that degree before.
Or self-purging. People would just say, screw this. I have a security clearance. I have experience. I can make more money working, you know, for Raytheon or building, you know, rat labs.
It's possible. I have been pleasantly surprised, not totally surprised, but certainly pleased by the fact that in the last few years, when you have had what you described as a tense relationship, to put it mildly, between the president and the intelligence community, at times going with the word of Vladimir Putin over the assessments of the intelligence community, at times comparing intelligence officers to Nazis, when you have that relationship, the fact that we have seen so few resignations tells me you have people putting their heads down, doing their job, because they realize the president is a valid customer of intelligence, and a very important one. We
always
call them the first customer. But guess what? There are thousands of other people who rely on top secret intelligence every day to do their jobs in national security. And if President Trump is not paying attention to the intricacies of diplomacy in Latin America, or the growth of economic and national security issues in Africa, or 20,000 other things going on around the world because he's only focused on one thing at a time, maybe the intelligence community officers have said, better that I stay and I have impact with the customers in the policy world who still care about those topics and are still doing it every day, rather than resign in protest, which won't actually change anything. Now, that's for the working level. At the leadership level, the dynamic changes a little bit, because they do have to protect their organization from unwarranted partisan interference. And if that happens, that puts all of them in a real bind to think, do I stay and shield things the best I can, Or do I resign because I can't look at myself in the mirror if I go along with the politicization of intelligence? That's a path I can't rule out. If there were a nominee who was determined to do this, there's a whole lot of levers they could pull to make that happen. That's my concern.
And there are, all, you know, as you pointed out with customers, there are other customers who can speak out. You know, even if the DNI is a mute or a spin master or whatnot, there are other IC customers, so to speak, who have that access to that information, who could either make it public or speak out or you know, affect policy changes in some way. Yeah. But the DNI, correct, and this is something I don't know the answer to, I'm sure you do, DNI can't fire Senate-confirmed people that answer to him or her.
No, the relationship—
He couldn't fire Gina Haspel.
Not directly. The relationship between the DNI and the heads of the intelligence community, it is, like I said, a coordinating role. It's, in a sense, a funnel for a lot of the activities of the intel community to the president, the National Security Council, to Congress in many ways. But it is not that he names and is able to hire and fire the directors of those agencies. Those are all, as you said, confirmed positions. But that is in a normal world. And you know, we're not living in normal times. If John Ratcliffe gets the ear of the president and says, I, as DNI, would like to fire the CIA director, but technically you have to do that. You could make that happen. There haven't been a lot of clashes at that level between previous, I would say DNIs, but technically it's D's and I, directors of national intelligence, and CIA directors and other leaders of the agencies.
See, it's proof that there are no R's. It's just D's and I's.
D's and I's.
It's the liberal deep
Things
state.
Things have really changed, yeah. Haven't they? But there was one case, which was back at the beginning of the Obama administration. The CIA director, Leon Panetta, was, as CIA director, the person who historically had nominated chiefs of station overseas. And there was reporting that Denny Blair, as the director of national intelligence, said, wait a minute, the whole intelligence community is represented in that country by those people. So I should have a role in nominating those people. And according to the reporting that came out, there was a clash between them. It went to the White House. And at the end of it, Leon Panetta was the one making those choices, not the DNI. Now, let's fast forward and do the same thing now. If Gina Haspel, let's say, has some issue, whether it's that or another issue, and says, Mr. President, this is the way we've always done things. But John Ratcliffe says, Mr. President, I'm doing what you wanted me to do. I'm fulfilling your mandate, and I want to do this instead. Who's to say the president is going to go with the way that professional intelligence operations have always gone, or he's going to go with his hand-picked person to go in and change things? I'm not optimistic on that front.
Yeah, there's a lot of concerning potential possibilities, but he has to get confirmed first.
Right on. And that's why I think that it'll be very telling to see what especially Republicans say and don't say in the next few days and next few weeks. It's also possible, we've seen this before with a few nominations to head the intelligence community, that when things came out, I mean, things that seem so innocent now compared to what we're seeing in today's world, but things like not paying for a nanny the correct way or not admitting that you had someone, not paying taxes for someone, things like that. We've had people withdraw from their own nominations.
Bernie Kerik.
Yeah, good example. And it may be that John Ratcliffe says, you know what? I thought this was going to help me in ways A, B, and C, but the heat coming on me for what was on my resume that may not bear out, or the things that are coming out about how experienced I am for the job, he may say, the old adage that no publicity is bad publicity doesn't apply when the publicity is really, really bad and might get in the way of me doing other things in my career. So he may, in fact, end up declining the nomination if Trump doesn't pull it first.
Especially if the heat gets too hot here. David Priest, thanks so much for joining us. He's the CEO of Lawfare and author of How to Get Rid of a President and The Presidential Book of Secrets, both great books. In fact, my brother-in-law stole The Presidential Book of Secrets from me because he was really wanted to read it. And so I'm itching to get that back. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, 8 Sleep. And thanks for listening. We will be back on Monday when, thankfully, Charlie Sykes will be back and you will have a return to normalcy.